Okay, so we'll continue for another 10 minutes. Then there will be Dhuhr prayer outside, and you can rush out right after that, inshallah. There are some questions here, actually. I remember now. Individual opinions of the Sahaba. If there are conflicting opinions among the Sahaba, some of them say something, some say something else, then this doesn't make it a sunnah. In that case, you have to apply the ayah that we said at the very end, which is فَإِن تَنَزَعْتُمْ فِي شَيْءٍ فَرُدُّهِ اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِكُ تُعِمِلَهُ الْعَتِبِ. If you differ about something, refer it back to Allah and the Messenger, if you believe in Allah and the last day. If they do not differ, if we know the opinion of one of two Sahaba in regard to a certain issue, and we do not know of anybody who opposes them, then we say that this is a strong evidence. This constitutes a strong evidence. And of course, if we know that this is the general opinion of the Sahaba, this becomes like a consensus or a great evidence. But that becomes, it's a sunnah of the Sahaba. But if it is one or two of the Sahaba, then it is a good evidence, but not necessarily binding, especially if you find some texts from the Sunnah to oppose it. Because sometimes it could be, you know, the ijtihad of the Sahabi, and there is a hadith that differs from that ijtihad that the Sahabi never knew, for example. And we have examples of that. If you go to the book by Ibn Taymiyyah, what is it called? The رَفْعُ الْمَلَامِ عَنِ الْأَئِمَّةِ الْأَعْلَامِ, lifting the blame from the great imams, you find, I don't know if it was ever translated, you will find that he gives examples, authentic examples, of how, for example, Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu made ijtihad sometimes in certain matters, and Umar also made ijtihad, and it was wrong. It was contrary to a hadith that the Prophet ﷺ said. And later on, people told Umar that, no, the Prophet ﷺ said this in regard to the diyah, for example, of the cutting, somebody cut another person's finger by mistake. How we deal with this and other issues. So he gave a judgment, and then he knew that somebody told him, no, the Prophet ﷺ considered all fingers to be the same. He gave different diyah for different fingers, and so on. So it could be that the Sahaba make ijtihad based on their general knowledge of the Sunnah, but then there could be a hadith different from their ijtihad, and in that case, that gives the precedence and not what they said. But if there is absolutely no hadith, no other evidence, and you have a saying by a Sahabi, this Sahabi is better than my saying, is better than your saying, better than the saying of any other alim. So I would rather take the saying of the Sahabi than anybody else after him. Allahu alam. Okay. I don't know, people seem to worry much about gelatin in this community for some reason. I keep getting questions about gelatin for 3 days in a row. Okay, as I said, yesterday or the day before, I forgot, I said that gelatin, we cannot say for sure that gelatin is haram. Actually, most likely it's not. Because regardless of what its source is, regardless of what its source is, because it has totally different chemical structure from the original structure of the fats and materials from which it came. Okay, we did some research on this in the past, and we wrote letters and got answers from the Jello company, and we found also that the what's it called, the FDC or whatever the authority in the States that deals with foods does not consider gelatin as under its jurisprudence, because it doesn't consider it a food. So gelatin is totally different from its source, whatever its source was. And therefore we cannot say that it is haram. We cannot say that it is haram. It is, yani we need a proof when you have a final product in your hand, regardless of where it came. Yani maybe you have this bottle in your hand. Somebody gave it to you. And maybe this bottle was made through a battle where many people were killed, and finally, you know, they were able to rescue this bottle and gave it to us. So it was done through a lot of killing and bloodshed and so on. And killing and bloodshed is haram, we know, of course, but we cannot say that this final product is haram. Because you know, the concern is what's here, not what happened before. Now for gelatin, and I mentioned also another example, vinegar, we don't care how it was produced, as long as we have the final product, it is halal. Now the method of producing it is important, of course, but it's not, doesn't have a bearing on the final product itself. The method itself could be halal or haram. Yani it could be vinegar could be produced directly from the juice, or could be produced by making alcohol first, and then from the alcohol you make vinegar. And the Prophet ﷺ prohibited this. But if some people do it like this, which is what they often do in the Western countries, then you cannot say that the resulting vinegar is haram. You say the process is wrong, and a Muslim is not allowed to do it that way. If he does it that way, he will be sinning, but still the final product will not be haram. The same about gelatin. You are not supposed to use pig to make gelatin, but if you use it, if it is used by some people, the final product is not haram. And as for those who say halal on the container, they probably mean that it is made from beef or from vegetables and so on, because it doesn't have to be that all gelatin is made from pork. It could be made from some other sources. Is doing tasbih using beads a bid'ah? We already said it is. I'm not sure, because the Tablighi people say that Abu Bakr used to use that stone to do tasbih. Well, this is not the only hadith da'if that they use. What is the sunnah way of making tasbih? The sunnah way to make tasbih is with your fingers. As the Prophet ﷺ used to do, he used to make tasbih with his fingers. And he used to say that they are mustantaqat, which means they will be made to witness on the Day of Judgment of the tasbih that you made with them. Some say our beloved Prophet ﷺ is still alive and he listens to our salam and salah. Please clarify. He is alive. You can check. I have discussed this in depth in my book Al-Barzakh, which is available here. There is a big chapter about the prophets and their graves. But to answer this briefly, he is alive, but his life is not like ours. It is a life of barzakh. So he's living a life that has nothing to do with us. And he has no communication with us at all, except in that when we say salam, Allah appoints an angel to carry our salam to him, so that he will answer our salam. So that's a merit that Allah gave to him and to the one who says salam to him. But it doesn't mean that he hears us or can answer us by, you know, like somebody make dua, oh Prophet give me this and that. Like some people go to the Prophet's grave and they hide papers, requests in their pockets, and when the guards are not watching, they try to slip them between the bars or in the holes, throw them in so that the Prophet will read them and answer their requests. This is all shirk, actually. This is all shirk. The Prophet ﷺ is not in this world now. He is living a life of barzakh, and he is in Jannah with the other prophets. and his body is in his grave, and so on. So it's a different life. And as I said, if you want to understand it better, you need to read the book of Al-Barzakh. In the Ma'raj journey, it is said that Rasulullah spoke to Allah about 9,000 words. Is it correct that he spoke 9,000 words? I don't know where they bring this 9,000 from. This is the first time I ever heard it. And I read all the authentic reports of the Ma'raj, and I think I compiled most of them in one of my books, I think the Dream book, one of my recent books. Maybe the Book of Dreams. So you can refer to that hadith there and see how the Ma'raj happens. Okay. What is the reward for reviving a sunnah action? The Prophet ﷺ said, this is a good question because it adds some explanation that I missed during the lecture. When we talked about that there is no bid'ah that is considered good. Some people use a hadith in which the Prophet ﷺ said, well, the hadith goes as follows, that there were some people, very poor people, from Mudar who came to the Medina. And when the Prophet ﷺ saw them, he became very upset, very sad, because he realized how poor they were. And in total, poverty. So he stood on the minbar, and he said, and he made a khutbah and addressed his companions, saying, تَصَدَّقَ رَجُلٌ بِدِرْهَمِهِ بِدِينَارِهِ بِصَاعِ بِرِّهِ بِصَاعِ قَمْحِهِ. So he was encouraging the companions to bring whatever they have as sadaqah, as charity, so to help these people. And it seems that it was at a time when the Sahaba themselves were not all that well off, so they did not move from their place for some time, and the Prophet ﷺ became even more upset. But then one of the companions left and went to his house, came back carrying a parcel, and he put it in front of the Prophet ﷺ. And some reports say that that parcel contained gold. And then when the people saw him, they started going and bringing stuff, until there were two great piles in front of the Prophet ﷺ. One pile of clothes and the other pile of food. So when the Prophet ﷺ saw that, his face became shiny with happiness. And he said, مَنْ سَنَّ فِي الْإِسْلَامِ سُنَّةً حَسَنًا فَلَهُ أَجْرُهَا وَأَجْرُ مَنْ تَبِعَهُ فِيهَا إِلَى يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ وَمَنْ سَنَّ فِي الْإِسْلَامِ سُنَّةً سَيِّئَةً كَانَ عَلَيْهِ وِزْرُهَا وَوِزْرُ مَنْ تَبِعَهُ فِيهَا إِلَى يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ. Which means whoever starts in Islam a good sunnah, then he will get the reward for it and for anyone who follows him into it until the day of judgment. Some people use this to say, look, the Prophet ﷺ said there is a bid'ah hasana. There is bid'ah hasana. Where is the bid'ah hasana in this hadith? He said sunnah hasana. Sunnah hasana. And the man was actually obeying the Prophet, so he was fulfilling his sunnah. The Prophet said, pay sadaqah, he went and brought sadaqah. So it's no proof for what they say. So whoever starts or revives a sunnah, he gets a reward, yani for that sunnah that he revived, and also for anyone who follows him into that until the day of judgment. And I have more discussion of this hadith also in the book of Barzakh, in the chapter about the rewards of ongoing deeds and the punishment, the ongoing rewards for some deeds and the ongoing punishment for other deeds. Okay, so that's it. Can you comment on the statement, you will never understand Quran until you learn the Sunnah? Can a person gain understanding of Quran by reading without the Sunnah? Well, depends on your level of understanding of the Arabic language. You will, if you have good understanding of the Arabic language, you will grasp a good portion of the meanings of the Quran by reading it without any explanation. But you will miss a lot as well. And sometimes you will fall into major misconceptions. So the way to clarify that is by going to the Sunnah, definitely. Because, as Allah Azza wa Jal said, وَأَنزَلْنَا إِلَيْكَ الذِّكْرَ لِتُبَيِّنَ لِلنَّاسِ مَا نُزِّلَ إِلَيْهِمْ, which means we sent down to you the dhikr, the Quran, so that you, O Muhammad, will clarify to the people what has been revealed to them. So he is telling us, Allah is telling us, that we need the clarification of the Prophet ﷺ to understand the Quran. He's saying that. So we definitely need the Sunnah to fully understand, or to well understand the meanings of the Quran. Okay. Can you see a person's taqwa from their actions or by their clothing? Allah Azza wa Jal says, فَلَا تُزَكُّوا أَنفُسَكُمْ هُوَ أَعْلَمُ بِمَنِ اتَّقَى, which means do not praise each other by saying that they have taqwa, because it is He who knows who has taqwa. Yani Allah is the one who knows who has taqwa in his heart. And in the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, when he mentioned many things regarding how a Muslim should deal with another Muslim and not hurt him, he said, التقوى ها هنا, التقوى ها هنا, التقوى ها هنا, pointing to his heart. Taqwa is right here, taqwa is right here, which means it's in the heart. Okay? So taqwa is not something that you can display and show to people. However, the actions are usually an indication of what is inside, in the heart. Yani if a person acts in a bad way, we know that he doesn't have taqwa. There's no way that a person is drinking khamr and smoking and doing all sorts of wrong things, and a woman not properly dressed, and we say, but she has taqwa, alhamdulillah. It's impossible. That person will not have taqwa. Maybe he has a certain small level of taqwa in some regards, but on the overall, we cannot say that such a person has taqwa. Okay? On the other hand, when there is a good tree, it will give good fruits. When the roots are good, the fruits will be good. So when there is a good heart, it would give good results. It would give good actions. So when you see good actions on a person, you would expect that his heart is good. And of course, there is all the chance that he's a hypocrite. But Allah knows best about these things. That's why, if you see somebody that you expect that he has taqwa, you have to be careful not to say, this person has taqwa. You say, we hope that he has taqwa. He appears to have taqwa. And we usually say the disclaimer statement, Wallahu hasibu, which means Allah is his witness. Because to us he appears to have taqwa, but Allah is his witness. Okay, last question. There are two more questions actually, but I think we are way past the time. What should we do? Okay. Is organ donation permissible in Islam? No, because our organs do not belong to us to donate them. They belong to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The final, what's the place of in ijma and the methodology of Muslims? Yeah, ijma is a very high level of dalil or evidence in addition to what is in the Quran and the Sunnah. Okay? If the Ummah approves something without knowing, the Ummah means the ulama of the Ummah, without knowing anybody who goes against them and disagrees with them of the ulama, then this is something great that gives us a strong level of certitude as to the opinion in regard to that issue. But as some of the ulama have shown, that actually ijma' is one of the hardest things to ever prove. It's so hard to prove. Yani there are ulama who wrote books about ijma' and they show you that there is ijma' in this issue and this issue and this issue and this issue. And if you look closely into these issues, you find that there is no ijma'. And sometimes when they said there is ijma', like in the book Maratib al-Ijma' or other books, you find that they meant ijma' in their madhab. In the Shafi'i madhab only, for example, or in the Hanbali madhab and so on. But not among all the ulama of Islam. And you would expect ulama in a certain madhab following only certain guidelines, most of the time they'll have a lot of ijma' among them. But the ijma' that is really strong and carries a great weight is the consensus of the Sahaba radiallahu anhum, and or of the ulama, a whole generation of ulama that came after them or after them and so on. And this, as I said, it is very hard to prove, but if it proves true, then of course it's a strong evidence. What does the jama'ah mean in Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah? I have actually a talk that I gave once about the meaning of the jama'ah that took about an hour and a half to 2 hours. If you are willing to sit, I'll explain to you the meaning of the jama'ah. But mainly the jama'ah, people misuse the words. When they say Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah, they misuse it. Sometimes they mean other than what it should mean. Jama'ah means the jama'ah who follow what was the Prophet ﷺ was upon and his companions. And in that sense, it is only one jama'ah from the time of the Prophet ﷺ to our time. There's only one jama'ah. And if you follow that, you are part of that jama'ah. Okay? Regarding the hadith of Arbad bin Sariyah, who are the rulers we are commanded to obey? Okay. The rulers who we are supposed to obey, listen to and obey, are those that the Prophet ﷺ explained in other ahadith, that they are the ones who establish the prayer among the Muslims. مَا أَقَامُ الصَّلَاةَ فِيكُمْ. Yani who at least claim that they pray, and they establish the prayer. They do not stop the prayer or Muslims from praying, which means they apparently are Muslim rulers. How about rulers of Muslims who are not even Muslims, or who they try to stop many of the teachings of Islam? In that case, you go by what the ulama of the ummah guide you to do. Yani normally, like revolting against them will cause greater harm than good in the ummah. And therefore, instead of getting yourself busy attacking those rulers and saying you have to go against them and fight them and so on, get yourself busy teaching Muslims their true Islam, teaching yourself, your family and so on. I remember once I was giving a talk in the Regent's Park Masjid in London. I don't know if anybody knows it. This is a very big mosque, maybe the biggest in London. And it was a Sunday morning talk. So I was giving a morning talk, and one of the people of Hizb al-Tahrir, or a group of Hizb al-Tahrir, were present there. It seems that they have a regular halqa on Sundays in that masjid. So we had permission from the leadership of the masjid, from the council of the masjid, or people in charge, to give the talk. And I was sitting in the front next to the member on table and giving a talk. And they were upset about this, why we are interrupting their talk. So they were very impolite. And then In the middle of my talk, I think, or when we started answering some questions, one of them raised his hand and he said, what you say about King Fahd? What you say about King Fahd? I told him, first of all, I have nothing to do with King Fahd. I live in the States and I'm originally from Lebanon. And I probably went to Saudi Arabia once or twice in my life. That's it at that time. So I have nothing to do with King Fahd, first of all. Second of all, your question has nothing to do with my topic. Third of all, your question has nothing to do with you. Why you ask about King Fahd? Why you ask about other people, rulers of Muslims, and what they do and what they do not do, and whether what they do is right or wrong, when you yourself have so many problems, as I can see from your appearance, that it's not the appearance of a Muslim. So go correct yourself before you correct King Fahd. So he started shaking his head and his group shaking their head and they walked out at that time. And I said a few more words, of course. But this, yani, dealing with the rulers is not really wise for us Muslims, because we have so many more things that are much, much more urgent for us to do. So why do we have to say, how do you deal with this ruler, and which ruler are you supposed to obey and which you are not supposed to obey? We are supposed to obey the rulers for the overall well-being of us and the other Muslims. Okay? And we find that every time there is a clash between some ignorant group of Muslims and some rulers in any country, you find that they tighten the snare against all Muslims in the world, even those who are only preaching in a good manners, good behavior, etc., etc. So they are stopping putting barriers, more and more barriers in the way of da'wah because of those ignorant people. So I see more harm coming to us from those ignorant people that claim that they are Muslims than is coming to us from non-Muslims, really. SubhanAllah. So anyway, this is my answer to this question. And maybe I spilled over to something else. Go ahead, brother.
Regarding the stopping women going to the masjid, it happens in most of the Asian countries.
Women going to the masjids? Well,
we know it was not done in most of the time, but they claim that Omar implemented it, so where do we stand?
I don't know that Omar implemented it. It's rather the other way around.
The woman stopped it.
I don't know that Omar stopped it either. No, that's not true. But the beginning of the hadith, you have to take the whole hadith. The Prophet ﷺ said, "La tamna'u ima Allahi masajid Allah." Do not prevent Allah's slaves, the ima Allah, which means women, from going to the masajid of Allah. And وَبُيُوتُهُنَّ خَيْرٌ لَهُنَّ. Then he advised the woman. First he commanded men. That was a command to men and an advice to women. وَبُيُوتُهُنَّ خَيْرٌ لَهُنَّ. Even though their houses are better for them. Yeah, of course. So Ibn Umar radiallahu an, one of his sons said, when he reported this hadith, his son said, "Wallahi lanamna'ahun. Wallahi lanamna'ahun." He said, "By Allah, we are going to prevent them." And Ibn Umar told him, his father, said, "I tell you, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, don't stop them. And you say we will stop them? I will never talk to you anymore." And he died without talking to him. So he deserted his son for good after that, because he showed disobedience to the Prophet ﷺ. So it's not a little thing, yani, to disobey the Prophet ﷺ. So anyways, I mean, there's no proof. I don't know of any proof to prevent the woman. Yani, there are some reports that some of the women, Aisha radiallahu anha, it is authentic also, said if the Prophet ﷺ was alive until our time, he would have prevented women from coming to the masajid. And then some other people after her said, this is what Aisha says in her time, so how about our time? He would certainly have prevented women from coming to the masajid because the way they are dressed and the way they go and so on. But all of this, you know, is an assumption from Aisha radiallahu anha or whoever came after her. But neither she or no one after her said, therefore it is prohibited for women to go to the masajid, because they all still adhere to the command. They did not reject the command. They did not say, no, the command should be that they are not allowed. They said he would have. But Allah would have told him if this should have been changed. If this instruction should have been changed. Wallahu a'lam. Okay, subhanakallahu wa bihamdik, ashhadu an la ilaha illa ant, astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk.